You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Brookings webinar on what to expect on tech policy in the next presidential administration. And with less than 30 days away, we're excited that you took the time to join us today. I am Nicole Turner-Lee. I am Senior Fellow at Brookings in the Governance Studies Program and the Director of our Center for Technology Innovation. I'm also the co-author of Tech Tank and our newly released podcast, Tech Tank. Darrell West and myself are co-hosts, and we ask that you also log on to that on Apple, Acast, and Spotify. You can also go to the Brookings website to find more information. I'm excited today because I actually get to be a part of the conversation. We are joined by a good friend, somebody I think we all pay attention to. When I heard that she was able to do it, I just got like a fangirl because Alexander Levine is like somebody we all want to be in Morning Tech of Politico. It's just, it's a mark of a sign of strength to be mentioned in that blog there for her. And so she is going to be our moderator today. I'm excited that she's going to do this because she knows tech policy and she knows it very well. I'm also excited to be joined by my colleagues. We've got Bill Barr, who is actually a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He comes to us as a former attorney within the Department of Justice dealing with issues on antitrust and competition. And Alex Engler, who is also a colleague of mine, who's the David Rubenstein Brookings Fellow in governance studies, as well as an adjunct professor at Georgetown. So please ask questions as you will during this event. Remember to send them to events@brookings.edu. And let's put your comments on Twitter, hashtag policy2020, so that we can follow this conversation during it as well as after. Thanks again. And I'm going to be quiet now and hand it over to our esteemed moderator, Alex, who's going to take it from here. Thanks, Alex, for doing this.
Thank you, Nicole. Again, I'm Alex. I'm a tech reporter at Politico, and I'm author of Politico's daily newsletter, Morning Tech. And I'm really excited to be a part of this conversation just a few weeks out from the election because there's still so much that we don't know about how this will play out, who will be at the helm in the next administration, and what all of it means for the tech world. And we've got our wonderful panelists over at Brookings to help us read the tea leaves on that. So as Nicole mentioned, viewers can submit questions for speakers by emailing events@brookings.edu or submit them on Twitter using the hashtag policy2020. So with that, let's jump right in. And I want to start by setting the stage for what tech policy issues are most likely to be at the top of Trump and Biden's lists heading into the next presidency. So high level, what do each of you see as the one top tech innovation or tech or innovation policy priority for each of the candidates respectively? And let's start with Nicole and then Alex and then Bill.
Yeah, I would like to actually say this one word that starts with an A, but I'm going to actually leave that for Bill because I don't want us to have glaring agreement on all what the issues are. I do think between the two of them that we're going to continue to see infrastructure be really important. I think that if Biden's campaign strategy is to build America better and Trump's is to make us great again, I think infrastructure, particularly broadband infrastructure, will still be at the helm of both of their concerns. I think that's an issue also that may give them the most bipartisan support, particularly if we're looking at where we need infrastructure in this new digital normal, where kids need to go back to school and employees have to go to work and families have to get healthcare online. Getting people infrastructure, I think, will resonate, Alex, with both campaigns. And if done properly, could actually be a good quick win because I think there's been enough momentum over the last years, not necessarily by a president, for actually paying attention to making sure that people are fully connected. And so going forward, I put it out for infrastructure as my main one thought, although you know I have a few others, but I'll leave it to my colleagues to share.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I think a really important thing to consider when looking, especially towards a potential Biden administration, is there's going to be a hierarchy of policy goals. And at the very top of that hierarchy is the COVID response and the economic recovery. And everything that the Biden administration might want to do early on is going to filter through that lens. How does your whatever policy fit into this plan, right? It's enormous stakes politically for that potential administration. And so you can imagine things, as Nicole was just talking about, broadband funding, maybe 5G investment falling into that in the same way that some of those issues fell into the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act when Obama came into office after the Great Recession. And so you'd be crazy not to sort of have that as your first expectation, I think. I'll let Bill talk about antitrust, as we were just saying. But you could also imagine some other things falling into this, right? For instance, maybe people make a successful argument that health misinformation on digital platforms and the web should fall into this sort of COVID response. And then maybe it sort of climbs the ladder in terms of what policy issues in tech get addressed. You know, after that, I think there's a backlog of issues that I'm hoping to talk about today, not only antitrust, but also comprehensive privacy legislation and also maybe artificial intelligence legislation, too.
So I guess out of the A word, I guess. Antitrust, I think Alex is right, is not going to be the first tier priority, but it is something that under either a reelected Trump or a newly inaugurated Biden is likely to be an issue. If it's Trump, it's almost certain that the Justice Department will be at war with Google, will have filed a case there. The FTC is reportedly close to challenging Facebook. There are lots of members on the Hill who are on the Republican side who are concerned about alleged bias against conservative viewpoints on tech platform. So you could see a storm of efforts directed at the tech platforms. If it's Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, it'll depend a lot on the personnel. We'll talk more about this later, but there is a huge debate about the role of antitrust right now and going forward. Is it undershooting the mark? And I think if you look at the Sanders-Biden unity agreement, Biden embraced a lot of more progressive Sanders and Warren thoughts about where antitrust ought to go and how it ought to be used. So if it's Biden, you can expect some significant movement, maybe even some legislation. If it's Trump, it's more likely to be a series of transactional moves without a dramatic change from what has happened so far in the first 4 years.
So I do want to get back to antitrust, and I do want to get back to broadband, and we will. But before we go there, you know, you've all brought up sort of how they differ in their approaches to these couple of issues you just mentioned. But I want to look briefly at an area where we're seeing some overlap, that big tech is in many ways a common target right now for both Biden and for Trump. And so, Nicole, this is a question that we got from Gary Arlen, president of ACL, who asked us to more closely look at the tech lash. So is the tech lash that we're seeing right now likely to continue under either administration, or would one ticket be more of a relief for Silicon Valley than the other?
You know, I think to that question, I actually think it's going to continue, and I'm going to tell you why. I think that the tech lash issue is less about who actually wins the presidency and more about the Congress. I think we've have built up some momentum among the Republicans as well as Democrats as to how through what they want to handle tech lash going forward. And I think given like the series of hearings that have happened in the last couple of months, and the fact that at 3 o'clock while we're on, you know, Cicilline is going to release a draft of his report on competition and, you know, antitrust issues and marketplace failures. What I think is going to happen is whoever wins is going to be dictating their agenda based on their party. And that, I think, is going to have a significant impact on whether or not any of these Silicon Valley companies are given any leeway along the way to sort of come out and rebrand themselves. I also think what's going to happen as part of this, just another side note, is that all these tech companies are going to be looped in together, and there's going to be very little differentiation over how they are distinctly different in the marketplace, which I think might also be a challenge for both sides to do so. One, because Trump hasn't had any comprehensive policy. I think Bill is completely correct that his actions towards these tech companies have been very transactional and based on any kind of personal relationship. And I think on Biden-Harris side, you know, particularly because, and I don't know if you're going to ask this question, but I may answer it anyway, right? This perception that Senator Harris is cozy with the Silicon Valley companies is going to sort of dominate the discussion on whether or not she could actually be neutral. And I think going forward, I honestly think the Democrats will have no choice but to come out pretty strong on the public-facing side to ensure that they're taking care of business for the party. And so going forward, I think that's going to be where I sit on that one, Alex, that this is still going to be an issue. And I think how that dictates through Congress is actually going to drive the extent to which we see some action.
So you got my next question exactly, which is about the coziness and about this, you know, this appearance that because the Obama White House was known to be chummy with Silicon Valley, and those were really the formative years for Silicon Valley when many of the social media companies that are now these powerhouses really kind of came into their own and became these giants as we know them today. So yes, I was going to ask whether a Biden administration would need a return to that at all. I guess if you look at it from a little bit of a different way, where do you think that Biden's approach to tech will diverge from where Obama stood on tech?
I can jump in here, which is, you know, just in short to say that I think if you have an administration that can be meaningfully moved by advocates, right, you're going to see a change in their strategy from sort of public pressure towards more systemic regulatory reforms. There is a limit to how much public pressure can do. Journalists and scholars have done, I think, extraordinary work revealing the harms of technology companies, but it is fairly easy for them to do small incremental changes and then say, we address the problem and then brush it away. Because reporters and academics don't have the right incentives. They're not resourced to return systemically to the same problems over and over again. So a lot of these advocates who have been thinking about this work for 4, 6, 8, 10 years now, I think are going to push for a more systemic reaction. And that certainly could be antitrust. It also certainly could be a regulatory authority. And, you know, it's not just David Cicilline, right? Mark Warner has a progressively expanding list of proposals around technology policy that could be quite significant. And so I do think we should, you know, it's techlash feels almost like it's a little like, I don't know if it sort of demonizes, but the harms are quite real. And I think we've seen a pretty big shift in where the Democratic Party is in terms of tech policy. And just to Bill's point a second ago, who ends up joining the Biden administration, I think will have an enormous impact on what potentially that would look like.
Right. So Politico reported recently that Facebook had that the Biden transition team had hired a former Facebook executive and that they had also hired a former Twitter public policy director to help on the transition front. And so I'm curious what that, you know, how that fares in terms of how Biden approaches tech policy and whether you expect to see more of this sort of revolving door strategy moving forward.
Well, I can jump in and then Bill, you go ahead. Let me jump in real quick on this because I want to capture a little bit what Alex said as well. You know, I think that's an interesting revelation that you actually reported on too, Alex, right? Because what that means is I think there'll be a lot of back behind the scenes negotiation that's actually going to happen to have the tech industry do some actually significant changes to their business models to actually appease, I think, some of the pushback that they've received just recently in the public. I mean, going back to what you asked in terms of Kamala Harris and how she's going to act with Silicon Valley, I mean, I think that might actually be a winning thing for her, right? An asset to Biden if she's able to take people in the back room and say, hey, you got to compromise somewhere versus embracing them and allowing that type of unregulated structure to reign. So I'm a little bit more optimistic that we actually might see Senator Harris play a big role in tech policy, in addition to this representation of now big tech leaders on the campaign being able to navigate through what they can actually do. Because remember, with Obama, they were there to help him with like the campaign tactics and approaches. We actually might see a little bit more in terms of how do we actually soothe this this debate and make it a little bit more friendly for negotiation or compromise, given that strategy. And I'm sorry, Bill, I just wanted to jump in there before I lost my train of thought.
you didn't lose it, and it came out perfectly. Look, if Biden wins and the Senate flips, I think you will see a strong likelihood of some modest modifications to the antitrust laws to make it easier for the government to go after acquisitions by dominant firms and bad behavior by dominant firms. We need to remind ourselves that current antitrust law, as interpreted by the courts, is quite conservative, very much Chicago school economics dominated. And that makes, you know, even a challenge that Bill Barr may bring to Google quite problematic. So I do think in order for law enforcement to be more effective, you're going to need some modest changes in law. At the same time, you know, our colleague Tom Wheeler has written about the need for ex ante rules that perhaps channel competition. I always look back to 2004 when the FCC basically said, you know what, your phone number is your phone number and you can move it to a different carrier, and stimulated all sorts of competition. I suspect there will be serious consideration given to empowering the FTC, possibly the FCC, possibly a new agency altogether, to try and guide competition in these platform markets where they seem to tip towards dominance of one firm.
So one related question from John Perino from the Glen Echo Group, and then we can go right back to antitrust. So John wrote in, and I'm paraphrasing this, how would the Trump administration versus the Biden administration run the tech-relevant federal agencies differently, and does this matter? So Nicole or Bill, if you want to jump in on this, that'd be great.
You know, I think it's interesting. I honestly have to give the tech industry, the tech agencies under Trump some credit. I mean, Lynn Parker with her AI governance structure and what they're trying to do with quantum computing has been real interesting, right? And Michael, as under his leadership there, I think we've seen the agencies operate somewhat independently from the administration. And I don't think that's going to change too much, that those agencies will still have a vested interest in ensuring some type of international cooperation or figuring out what other countries are doing to ensure we're harmonized with those rules, as well as coming up with their own systems, right, and processes, because these agencies at the federal level really don't have a lot of rulemaking authority. What might change, I think, are really the federal agencies that have rulemaking authority, like the FTC, like the FCC in particular. I think there we're going to see under a Biden-Harris ticket, you know, a lot more defining of what a structure looks like for governance. I believe what Bill said, that law enforcement will become a high priority for either agency. I think also they're going to pick people that also feel on the Biden-Harris side that have an attention to equity, potentially racial equity on both sides, to ensure that there's no COVID effect, as Alex has mentioned, in terms of groups being harmed by new technologies or emerging technologies. I think on the Trump side, things will remain the same. And I think that what we see today in terms of the independent oversight of these agencies who still take cues from their big boss as to whether or not they're taking the right approach will probably continue, right? The key thing is that something is going to happen, have to happen between both, because technology policy is not keeping up with technology innovation. And this new normal that we're coming out of is actually going to dictate the fact that we have new norms in town, which are really virtually everything digital. And so going forward, I think they're going to be even more important in terms of who runs them, what governance they actually adopt, and how they're accountable to the type of law enforcement structure to reduce consumer harms.
All right. And now returning to antitrust as promised. So I think this is the biggest thing on everyone's minds right now. And as you mentioned, Nicole, we're waiting for this report apparently to drop in about an hour. So we've already hit a little bit on the FTC, the Justice Department. And I want to look more closely at how there's these multiple investigations underway in lawsuit and look at what will happen to them come the next presidency. So the Trump administration, as I think you mentioned, planning to file this major Google lawsuit, major Google antitrust complaint any day now. The House Judiciary antitrust report is due in like 40 minutes. And so, Bill, what would a transition of power, a new administration or new regulators, what would that mean for the continuation of or the momentum around these sorts of efforts?
Well, I think if Biden-Harris win, you will see one of the earliest priorities likely be to see whether they can do some legislation, particularly if the Senate flips. The Cicilline report and the minority report that comes out of that subcommittee, I testified for that subcommittee on Thursday. I tell you, I was stunned by the areas in which many of the Republicans on that subcommittee supported changes to the antitrust laws in order to allow law enforcement to go after abusive behavior and inappropriate acquisitions by large firms, not exclusively focused on the technology firms, but a lot of focus there as well. So I think legislation, there may be a perfect storm that will, for the first time since the early 50s, involve substantive changes to antitrust laws. In the meantime, there'll be at least one case out there against Google. There are reports that the antitrust division career people think the case is not ready for prime time and that it's being brought in order to give a wedge issue to be used in the campaign. That's terribly worrisome. It's not the first time this administration has been accused of using antitrust enforcement to achieve political ends. I think it will kind of be a hot potato for the new head of the antitrust division and the new chair of the Federal Trade Commission, if there's a Facebook case pending, to figure out how to get that right. Just because the case may be brought prematurely and for the wrong reasons doesn't mean it's a bad case, that there isn't bad behavior out there that ought to be addressed. So it takes, as we all know, months for a new administration to form, for Senate confirmations to take place. So it will be sometime late spring or summer, I think, before some of these issues get addressed. But it is also possible. Amy Klobuchar has legislation in the Senate that is similar to some of the things that are contained in the draft minority report out of Cicilline's antitrust subcommittee. So I think you may see legislation before you see law enforcement changes, which is very, very unusual.
And Alex, returning to what you were saying a few minutes ago about federal privacy legislation. So we haven't gotten any yet, and many lawmakers thought we were going to see it sometime in the 116th Congress. Do you think that the passing of a baton to Biden-Harris would help or hurt prospects of a federal data privacy bill, and why?
I think it helps. I think there is just, you know, more likely to be oversight legislation on any topic functionally, right? And sort of just a pure interest in government, right? And expanding the capacity and function of government. And you have people, our colleague Cam Carey has written, I think really incisively about this, where I think there is a reasonably large amount of agreement around, you know, inhibiting the actions of data brokers, reducing the amount of data sharing across services without consent, maybe enabling people to opt out of some data sharing, as well as, you know, finding a little more alignment internationally. We're up against a really, you know, jarring relationship with the European Union's General Data Protection Regulation versus the sort of absence of that in the US, and then also some individual state policies that don't really align super well. So just the fact that the policy situation is a bit difficult for anyone to operate in at the moment. I think you could see everyone looking for some expanded safeguards around privacy and also maybe better international alignment at the same time. I'm sure Nicole has thoughts too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we are way overdue, Alex. You know this on both Alexes, right? On federal privacy standards. I mean, the EU beat us to it, and now we have this issue of preemption as well as private right of action, which our colleague Cam Carey has written extensively about, which are pretty much these blockages that started in the privacy debate and probably going to end in the privacy debate. But what I think is going to be most interesting, Alex, this kind of relates back to what you said. If this Biden-Harris ticket is going to be driven by COVID-19 relief, privacy may actually become something that's an expedited matter. And because people's data has really basically been collected throughout the course of the 7 months, and now we're seeing this overlay with health data, educational data, et cetera, that may make this more urgent, right? And in addition to the fact that we're also battling the tech companies and platforms, you know, having on the Democratic ticket an attention towards privacy may actually come in the favor of many of us that have been advocating to have this done quickly. Because I'm worried, and I think this speaks to particularly Senator Harris's role on the Biden side, that if there is this correlation between the data that's been collected and unequal outputs of discrimination for groups that are sort of being deceptively served, predatory products, services, vaccinations, you name it, I think there actually may be a push to put privacy legislation into place because it'll drive the rest of the ecology.
So just piggybacking off of that, tech continues to play this really significant role in the country's reckoning on race and race issues. Whether you gave some examples just now, Nicole, or the spreading of hate speech online or perpetuating bias through artificial intelligence, how do the two tickets differ in their approaches to some of these tech issues that are contributing to racial injustice?
Yeah, I mean, if I can, I'm going to do a big plug. We're doing on October 14th at Brookings a panel on white supremacy featuring the president of Brookings, John Allen, Darrell West, Dr. Fred Harris out of Columbia University and Keisha Blaine out of University of Pittsburgh. I mean, part of what we do want to do in that conversation is talk about, Alex, what you're talking about, right? Which is, do you reel this in? How can you reel it in when these are private platforms? To what extent does this go against First Amendment rights? I think all of that is going to be part of this conversation with tech policy on how do you maintain racial equity while at the same time ensuring that people have the livelihood to exist digitally and say what they want, when they want it, and how they want to say it, right? I do think under this administration, we will see some structural changes, though. I do believe that we'll see Senator Harris, who has been part of the Congressional Black Caucus, for example, begin to look at the workforce practices of tech companies and maybe develop a dashboard or some accountability around hiring, which has now come to fruition as one of the causes for why we see deepened discrimination. I also think that this administration is going to be highly attentive to misinformation, disinformation, election insecurities, right? And how that contributes to that and see what role they can play in making algorithmic accountability or content moderation much more transparent. I also think, and this is my last, I'm not a person who's actually a predictor, but I can tell by some of the actions on the Democratic side that you actually might see as part of like some regurgitated Kerner Commission report on equity, right, that takes on policing and housing and unemployment, actually a tech component. And I really think this administration may take that on previous to the 1970s or 80s, where tech wasn't driving democracy. The Trump side, you know, I think as Bill said, that we're gonna see an antitrust, that there'll still be the screaming that there's conservative bias, that they don't get enough attention, that the algorithm is not necessarily leaning towards inclusiveness. There will be no attention to the diversity around these companies and making those decisions outside of the fact they don't have enough conservatives on staff. But I also think that they'll be ruled still by the impulsiveness of this administration to sort of dismiss racial equity, dismiss racial division, and engender and embolden groups to continue these platforms to push their point of view. That's dangerous. We saw that with the dismissal of white supremacist groups or not denouncing white supremacist groups. And I think that's going to continue under this administration.
Can I add a thought there as well, actually? So I just want to mention two areas of artificial intelligence that are really criminal justice issues, both the use of facial recognition systems and also the use of predictive systems for things like bail release by criminal justice, by cities and states. Those have varying levels of efficacy, sometimes, you know, not working particularly well or not working in ways that are particularly fair. And you could certainly see a Biden administration interested in setting some sort of minimum standards for those. That's not definitely going to happen, but I think that's a conversation you'll see some advocates push for that could feasibly happen in a Biden-Harris administration that will get absolutely no attention in a Trump administration as it hasn't for the last 4 years. And so, you know, just there are some sort of these trickle down, what does AI mean in the criminal justice space stuff that I think is relevant too.
So while we're on the topic of AI, let's talk a little bit more about that. And I know that, Alex, a lot of your work has focused on this. So do you see Trump and Biden's approach to international AI policy as enormously different, or do you view it as an area where they are actually seeing maybe more eye to eye than they do on some other issues? And where can we expect to see the biggest investment and the most aggressive strides on developing and deploying artificial intelligence?
Yeah, I mean, the area where there's overlap is not trivial. There has been a huge investment by the Trump administration into research and development around artificial intelligence. Somewhere in the realm of, you know, the National Science Foundation just announced $500 million worth of spending. It's probably close to a billion a year if you include a bunch of other organizations like the Department of Agriculture doing precision agriculture work and also DARPA, not to mention an unbelievable amount of money on the defense side. And so there is certainly an investment in artificial intelligence development that I don't see why that wouldn't continue. You know, maybe other people come in and say this is drowning out research funding for other areas and it gets slightly reapportioned. That's possible. But I do think a lot of that funding stays. The Trump administration also entered into GPI, which is the Global Partnership on Artificial Intelligence, which is a French and Canadian-led initiative, now up to 15 or so countries, around sort of building what a democratic governance of, what is like a democratic government idea of AI? What's the alternative to digital authoritarianism? And there has been, you know, some progress there. That's in the early days. We're expecting to see some more work out of that group later this year. And I think both of those things we reasonably expect either Trump or Biden to continue. You know, on the Trump administration side, it's interesting that Michael Kratsios, who's the chief technology officer, has actually left the White House. And so maybe the most prominent and vocal person for artificial intelligence policy and that spending is actually gone. And so it does, you know, it's possible that Lynn Parker, one of the deputy CTOs who's been involved, will take that space, or maybe someone else. The big difference is on oversight. Right now, there's functionally no algorithmic oversight of any kind. You know, it's really early to see what might happen, but the Biden administration could go, they could do a little bit. They could set, they could, you know, promote the standards that some organizations are setting. They could just sort of raise the bar a little. They could also, you know, pass a new digital regulatory authority that has direct access to companies' data when they're suspected of, you know, breaking the law and algorithm. And there's some argument for that. At the moment, it's probably easier to get away with crimes if you put them in an algorithm. And so it's possible, you know, I think the range of potential outcomes there is pretty big on the oversight aside, so still to be seen.
Yeah. So if I could jump in, Alex. So Alex, you're calling that an algorithmic arrest, right? You just had me think of an arrest of an algorithm. And Bill, please jump in. I wanted to just tag on to what Alex said, though, about, you know, the oversight in the Trump administration was powerful, I think, because it was largely driven, again, by the independent, the agency acting independently of the administration. But I do think, Alex, what will also be interesting in AI will be this international component. And I'm not quite clear yet the Biden-Harris goal around China, right? And China has been very vocal about an AI arms race. I think the Trump administration has reacted to that sort of proclamation that they were going to be first to the MAGA platform. It's still unclear to me what Harris is and Biden-Harris are going to do with regards to managing that relationship generally in terms of China and more specifically in terms of Chinese tech. We've seen very blatant displays of, you know, I'm not going to call it xenophobia, whatever you want to call it, in terms of the concerns around espionage and piracy, et cetera, with China. I'm still not clear because I think this is a lot different from what Joe Biden had to deal with in the Obama administration. So going forward, we may actually need Biden-Harris, if they are elected, to start thinking about articulating what is Chinese policy, right? When it comes to AI, how much are we spending relative to R&D, relative to experimentation and trials? And to what extent does the United States really want to lead the conversations that are happening internationally on human values and civil rights principles, et cetera, going forward? So still, I'm still not clear what that's going to look like in terms of that relationship going forward yet on AI.
So because we're halfway through, I just want to put in one more plug for people to submit questions. We already have a handful that have come in. Again, you can submit questions by emailing events@brookings.edu, or you can submit them on Twitter using #policy2020. So a couple that just came in, this one's on Section 230 reform, and particularly timely because Trump tweeted about an hour and a half ago, repeal Section 230. So this one comes from Rebecca McKinnon of New America. And whoever wants to jump in on this one, feel free. So what are your predictions for the fate of 230 under Biden-Harris or a second Trump administration?
Well, go ahead, Alex. You go.
Okay. Predictions. Great. It's so close to the election. We can be wrong so quickly. You know, I think an important thing to keep in mind with 230 is that it's not a binary condition of the existence of Section 230 and the absence of Section 230. I think there are a reasonable number of proposals that make tech platforms slightly more responsible in various ways for content that are reasonable and will not destroy the free function of the internet. I would expect if there were changes to 230 under the Biden administration to be some sort of incremental change around the edges that makes them more responsible for, you know, child, maybe it's child pornography, maybe it's dangerous health misinformation, maybe it's private right of action when people are harmed by something on a platform. And that's not necessarily like the end of free speech on the internet. What Trump is tweeting about removing Section 230 would require legislation. I think Democrats are going to have none of it, and I don't think the likelihood that we have a Republican trifecta is very likely. And so I don't think that, you know, I think we're really talking about sort of incremental changes on the edges, and that might not be the worst thing.
Yeah, and I would say on Section 230, I mean, I think I agree with Alex in terms of, you know, how this is going to be a slippery slope. It already is showing itself a slippery slope with the administration calling for its complete repeal. I mean, there have been several advocacy groups that have actually put out really good proposals on whether or not we should just start from scratch, whether or not we should try to go around the edges and do some reform. But I think the challenge is going to be that whatever administration comes into play, there will be more or less some stress or pressure on censorship. And we obviously see that one of the reasons that the Trump administration wants to get rid of Section 230 is because they feel like their speech is being quelled. I always tell people, you know, people don't really think about, is it Section 230 or is it algorithmic amplification that's actually making this mode of speech less seen or more, you know, less visible to certain people who are empathetic towards conservative speech? We don't know. And I think that that's why we really need for, I think, a Biden-Harris ticket to come in and do a careful look and review, listen to civil society groups, look at how the law was written, you know, when we were looking at tech companies as publishers, see if we still have the same type of protections like child pornography, like other, you know, cases which could actually have high risk of harm if we didn't have this in place. And then just, you know, I think, and I want to actually refer to Bill to bring it back. It's like bringing you back on the court, my friend, right? I mean, I think the challenge is it's not just Section 230 by itself anymore. It's Section 230 and how that actually also factors into antitrust. That might also be an issue. Bill and I talked about this the other day, the extent to which we'll see a probable Trump-Pence administration, you know, aligning that with antitrust issues. So, Bill, I don't know if you want to kind of comment on this as well.
Sure. I the Attorney General has suggested that somehow private companies being biased against conservative viewpoints is an antitrust issue. That's sort of a novel application of the antitrust laws, but novelty and this administration have become pretty close friends, I think, over the last 3 years. So it is, again, symptomatic of the transactional outcome-oriented use of law enforcement by this administration. So I would not be surprised, Nicole, if in fact Section 230 an effort to get it employed. And indeed, there are stories out that last month, the president summoned FTC Chair Joe Simons into the Oval Office and told him, you know, to go after conservative viewpoints, use the FTC powers to do it. And Chairman Simons said, I don't have that authority. And result seems to be that they're interviewing already for his replacement.
Yeah, I mean, we saw similarly, and Alex knows this from Politico, with the FCC and the failure to renominate Mike O'Reilly. I mean, it's just a different type of administration when it comes to that. And I think, again, this is going to be a slippery slope. But hopefully, if we have either a newly inaugurated administration or an administration that begins to think that this transactional, impulsive way of governing tech policy doesn't work well, and effective, that perhaps we'll have some discussion and dialogue on what we should do with Section 230 to make it align with the other tech policy.
All right, and I want to switch gears to field this other question that we got from one of our viewers about the social dilemma. Have any of you watched The Social Dilemma? Yes, okay, Nicole has. So Robin Friedman says she watched the Social Dilemma documentary. Would either president, Biden or Trump, address what is necessary for social media to do to combat the destructive evil discourse rhetoric overexposing our nation, overexposing our nation, or that our nation is experiencing? How will they control the exponential increase in competition, profit accumulation at the expense of our safety and health?
Wow, what a question. You know, I give Tristan Harris a lot of credit. I mean, that was a really difficult film to make, but I think it was also, you know, a lot of the pioneering opinions of people who worked in these companies. And because it's a documentary and because it's film, you know, creative industry has different ways to tell the same story, you know, different sides to every story. But I do think what was interesting, and Robin, I can't answer all of this. I mean, obviously we know misinformation, disinformation is gonna be a hot topic. We're still trying to figure out as policymakers the extent to which we should actually doing some type of regulation around content moderation policies. I mean, as I just told a panel earlier today, these are private platforms. And I think Bill is more suited on the last one in terms of increased competition and profit accumulation and whether that or not that drives marketing. I mean, the thing that we have to remember about these platforms, and then I think I'll offer some advice to the new administration on what they should be focusing on that was disturbing to me in that movie. You know, at the end of the day, private companies have implications and private companies that go above the line in democratic processes have consequences. And so as we move forward, it's going to be up to each administration to sort of think through where can they, you know, with proper jurisdiction, actually regulate these companies and where can they, as we talked about earlier with Senator Harris, put these companies in good behavior around certain things that the American people have just suggested they don't like. But what I do think came out of that movie, for those who didn't watch it, that I think would be a fantastic policy pivot, and our friends over at the Family Online Safety Initiative have done this, as well as Common Sense Media, is we need policy making around young people and their use of social media. I think that there was something that touched me as a parent of a 13-year-old in terms of the associated depression that comes with overuse of social media, the alienation, and I'm concerned about that part of it. And I think under the Obama administration, we had a lot more efforts around cyberbullying. We had a lot more support of civil society groups to come up with rules of the road for parents. We have to remember, and I'll go back to what you said, we're facing two pandemics right now, a public health crisis, racial crises that have been historic. And now we have kids who are learning from their bedrooms and parents working while they're learning and families. I heard families breaking apart because one, they're realizing they shouldn't have been together this long, or two, it's just stressful. And so I think going forward from that movie, it would be helpful if either administration, I think Melania tried to do this with the cyberbullying, took on as a program or principle, how do we actually address some of the psychological consequences of what social media has brought on for younger children and students, and potentially be proactive to come up with a better rules of the road so we can actually pull back some of this mental health trauma that actually exists from young people in particular being glued to their social media properties.
I'd like to speak to this a little bit too, if that's okay. You know, it's worth noting that The Social Dilemma received some well-deserved criticism for ignoring early voices, especially women and people of color, from describing negative outcomes from tech platforms. Mozilla put together an actually a list of all the people they probably should have talked to, many of whom were early critics of technology innovation, you know, and especially a sort of permissionless innovation. And there's a part of that movie, I think people could be confused that it was a lot of participants in the tech industry waking up and saying, oh man, no one could have seen this coming. What a terrible outcome. When in fact, a whole bunch of people saw this coming and tried to tell you about it. Like, and so there was some criticism there, and that's worth weighing with, though I think the movie does have some informative parts. It's also worth considering what type of policy intervention might affect the issues that the movie's getting at, things like social media addiction, things like serious disinformation and misinformation. You could think of YouTube radicalization, you could think of QAnon and Boogaloo, and also election disinformation. And there is a really active discussion around the idea of a systemic duty of care. And essentially what a systemic duty of care is, you would pass in law a responsibility of, you know, of digital platforms of a certain size, right, that they have to care about presumably named societal impacts, including what we were just talking about, addiction, maybe harassment and bullying, maybe revenge pornography. And then you would say, you have to make this better, and we're going to have regulators keep an eye on you and observe that these things are getting better over time and you're actively investing in them. And I think there is a common an understandable perception that some of these digital platforms care dramatically more about expanding their user base and engagement than they do about really addressing these problems. And the systemic duty of care, the goal of it, and there are reasonable criticisms, but the goal of that would be to balance out that incentive structure and address some of the stuff that we heard about, the social dilemma, and also from these other scholars.
Great points. One more question. I think this is best for Bill. This is from Daniel Schiff. Will the changing composition of the courts alter tech policymaking and enforcement strategy?
Well, I think, we obviously are having a conservative tilt, which is not just socially conservative, it's economically conservative. And that will continue a trend, I think, to be very cautious about the application of the antitrust laws by the judiciary. And this runs from the district court all the way up to the Supreme Court. So I think that will be part of the impetus for modifications of the antitrust laws, the notion that we are getting increasingly cautious. It's kind of a one-way ratchet where the Chicago school philosophy is be very, very cautious and be biased against type one errors of over-enforcement. And you combine that cautiousness with the overall Chicago school philosophy, I think it's fair to say that we are getting significant under-enforcement, and that is only going to continue. So, and without changes to the antitrust laws, those people who are making articulate arguments in favor of an expansive view of what antitrust can and should do to make a better society, diminish income inequality, those sorts of things, the distance between that point of view and an increasingly conservative judiciary is larger than the Grand Canyon. And so there's got to be something that shrinks that chasm in order for antitrust to play a more significant, meaningful role in not just on the high-tech industry, but generally in our economy today.
Another question that we just got a few steps back to Section 230. This is from Heidi Legg. The answers and dance around Section 230 cause me concern that the panel is pro-tech with that responsibility. There's a major problem in our information ecosystem. How do you think we repair this and the vitality of journalism without revising Section 230?
Yeah, I can start. So two things. So one, getting rid of Section 230 outright would have serious consequences. We should really think about what those consequences are. Because, one of the core things it does do in defense of 230 is if you blanket make all online platforms responsible for the content of everything posted on them, it becomes much harder to run a place like Reddit or, Twitter to have those places exist at all. And that's a fair point, right? That it things do change if you just blanket get rid of 230. That being said, when I'm talking about kind of incrementally changing things, that doesn't mean we can't hold tech companies to substantially higher levels of responsibility for the type of content at scale, right? I think it's one thing to say you can never have health information on your website or you are liable to a lawsuit versus we're going to encourage and require a substantially expanded effort for you to reduce health information. Those are two very different things. And I think the latter is much more reasonable in a way of working with tech platforms in such a way that we can substantially improve the public discourse on the internet.
Yeah, and Heidi, Heidi's question actually reminds me of some work that the Knight Foundation did a few years ago with Information Society, right? Where it was chaired, I think, by Michael Powell, as well as other people who were on there from the Knight Foundation, President of Knight Foundation, Alberto, who basically tried to investigate the impact of technology on journalism. And I think, I agree with Alex from the standpoint, we at Brookings thinks that it should not be repealed. But what these two administrations may do is a totally different course of action. The key thing is, I think, adding to your question is, I think in any of these tech policy issues that our hope is that the Biden-Harris administration will have a much more calibrated, much more exploratory approach versus doing rulemaking or any type of transactional activity around any of these important issues. And I was thinking of when you actually sent that question and Alex just asked it around, you know, what we just saw with the FCC and media ownership and the fact that cross ownership is now another issue. And I was wondering, no one across both administrations has really taken a care about media ownership, except that we know this current one is not necessarily supportive of a diversity of voices in various marketplaces. And we need that more than ever. And so I think going forward, it's going to be important, I think, to think about the implications of Section 30 as it is written, whether or not it applies to the technological space today, and the extent to which, as Alex has said, we can salvage some parts of it that still provide the same protections, but the same token, see what else we need to do. Because I do believe that Section 230 also could be updated and modernized to look at algorithmic application as one of the other things that we need to put somewhere into any kind of revised language. But that comes from us, not necessarily what the administrations are gonna do. So thank you for that question.
We have another question about personnel in the future administration. So Yori Wormser writes, if Biden and Harris win, what would be some early appointments that would indicate a relatively aggressive approach on privacy and antitrust and internet access?
Well, I hope they don't take Cam Carey. I'll start there. He's not around in the Obama administration. So I'm hoping that he doesn't land up anywhere because we need him at CTI. And we actually have this great suite of former appointed and elected officials, including people like Bill, that we need to stay. So it makes my job easier. Go ahead, Bill.
I have learned over the years that predicting who will get one position is an absolute fool's errand. Within the antitrust community, there tends to be an echo chamber where somebody mentions a name and suddenly that is the name. And if I look back over the years, for the most part, those names weren't right. So I don't know people. I do know that there will be, or I believe there will be, some pressure from the Sanders-Warren wing of the party to put in position some of those people who have this more progressive, some people refer it to neo-Brandeisian view of what antitrust enforcement can and ought to be. And the challenge will be putting in those people with very progressive, interesting thoughts and how they get a conservative judiciary to buy into those constructs. And that's why I keep coming back to the notion that maybe the first step towards bridging the gap is some legislative modifications to the current antitrust laws.
And we got another question. This is about, this is on a topic we haven't hit on yet that I think is particularly timely because of COVID. What do the panelists think might be done by a future administration about gig workers and the gray legal area they currently exist in?
I think on the gig worker issue, it's just so fascinating. About 4 or 5 years ago at Brookings, we actually started talking about that with different countries, as a matter of fact, around whether or not there should be benefits sort of given to gig workers, given the sensitivity and the amount of hours, et cetera. And I think because of the permissiveness around the new economy and the digital sharing economy, right, there's was somewhat of a, not I want to say relaxed notion of it, but we kind of let it evolve, right? And so now, I honestly think where we are with that question is where we should be in terms of the evolution of those economies. And what COVID has done, particularly under Biden-Harris administration, is suggest that everyone needs access to economic stability and certainty. And the fact that these workers were part of the 40 million, right, over the course of time that we're receiving some type of unemployment benefit, I think concerned the Biden-Harris administration that we need to make sure that those families are covered. And I think going forward, there will be some conversation around that. I mean, I think the extent to which those workers actually include people of color will also be a factor in this, that, you know, Harris will obviously have some sensitivities towards making sure that workers who are low income or tend to be disproportionately minority have benefits going forward, which will make it more interesting. But I do think that we need to put our seatbelt on this as well. I think at the core of the Biden-Harris administration is going to be this return to work and this return to some type of economic security, which I don't think we should take lightly. I think if the Trump administration was interested in this, we would have heard about it already. And so obviously it's not part of their suite of demands at this time. And I'm not sure where it actually fits in, to tell you the truth, with all the other demands in terms of, you know, getting rid of TikTok and these other demands that have hit their surface. But I do think that a Biden-Harris administration should concern those ride-sharing companies and other digital sharing companies that have sort of been put to the side and not necessarily in the crux of the big tech debates, that I think that's going to come up as something important.
Yeah, can I just one thought to add, which is the number of companies that are doing this type of thing is going to grow, right? This kind of hybrid algorithmic worker, either management system or even people working along with various automated systems, more and more jobs are going to look like that. And this warrants our consideration now. We have not only Uber and Lyft, but also Amazon, which is tracking efficiency and generating automatic warnings and some accusations of automatic terminations, right? And it's pretty clear that in the weeds, the conditions of some of these jobs are pretty bad. Amazon has recent reports just said very high injury rates for their warehouses, right? And you may expect that if you track if you're tracking the ability to move boxes absolutely constantly, you can imagine how that becomes a threat to personal safety and maybe not where their algorithms are effectively optimizing for. Same, we had dangerous driving conditions of Amazon contractors come up. Maybe last year was sort of the story that broke on that. And so, in these areas, if we're going to see this more and more, and we see the sort of algorithmic management driving really specific outcomes, how fast can you make a delivery? How fast, how many packages can you sort in a day? And yet a lot of distancing from the actual responsibility for those workers, especially in the case of Uber and Lyft, especially in the Amazon contractors of their drivers. I think there's a serious reason to think about raising the standards of those gig workers and also raising the level of responsibility that the parent company has for those workers.
Right. And if I could add on that too, Alex, just what you said. I mean, I think the analog life has left. It's going away, folks, right? And every company right now, the United States is a tech company. It doesn't matter if you're a commerce company, if you're a bank, you are a tech company. And COVID basically suggested that going online was the only way to actually get things done. And given the precariousness of the economy and the fact that we're trying to get people back to work, we're going to see more jobs like this, right? And I think the thing that is going to be concerning to an administration that is trying to actually jumpstart economic recovery, bring back some kind of normalcy in terms of worker stability, allow people to have the relevant benefits that they need, that what will be interesting in this growth of innovation will be, I guess, this new framework for looking at workers and work. And so I'm just fascinated by how each will handle it, but I do think a Democratic ticket will actually start paying attention to this more, and it will spiral and be felt throughout all of the sectors that try to do what Alex said, just find ways to bring people back to work without keeping them as a full-time employee, but rather doing some type of independent contract status.
So with that, we've got just a few minutes left. So I want to close with one sort of lightning round. And I'd love for each of you to answer this. What is one newer or emerging tech issue that is likely to move center stage and become a bigger, more pressing focus in the next 4 years? And this could be something that might not be on people's radar or isn't being discussed enough right now. So let's start with Bill, and then we can go to Alex and then Nicole.
Sorry, it was a late unmuting. I actually think AI and antitrust are going to be an issue that is going to get increasing prominence. The ability through AI for a firm or a platform to set individual prices for individual consumers based on their history of purchasing will change and potentially discriminate against people who don't do the kind of comparison shopping others do. And the role of antitrust in figuring out whether and how to regulate or to enforce against what could be massive price discrimination is an issue that hasn't been talked about a lot, but I think we'll hear more about in the next 4 years.
Yeah, there's a couple largely theoretical AI papers that show that if you let two artificial intelligence systems set prices and compete with each other, they will learn to coordinate on their own and start setting higher prices, because if they both do that, they both make more money. Anyway, mostly theory, but yeah, it does certainly raise that specter that Bill mentioned. I think this is not under discussed, but I think it's maybe the most important single big picture issue, which is that the large scale collection of data by companies about people is undermining their individual capacity in the economy and in and even sort of learning effectively. Right? We are giving more and more information capacity to ad tech. We are giving up more and more autonomy in making decisions around even how we get around, like at Uber, in sort of what our jobs look like. And we don't have a systemic societal interest pushing back effectively across the board. And so rather than name a specific issue, I just kind of want to zoom out and maybe suggest that what we need is a comprehensive plan. I mean, the number of tech policies that you can talk about where we have separate isolated sort of solutions for or approaches for is enormous. And maybe we need to be thinking a little bit more holistically about one where we can sort of increase, you know, the society's autonomy and power relative to a growing amount of influence in commercial tech.
So I know we only have less than a minute, and we had to have you say something, Alex. I'll just say ditto to my colleagues, and I'll add this one thing that also is a shameless plug because I have a book coming out on this next year at Brookings Press, Digital Efficacy. So I do think one thing that we did not talk about is going to be this whole issue of the digital divide comprehensive, what needs to be done so that everybody is connected, so that our kids can go back to school and still learn and our people can work and our networks can be more efficient and we can move into 5G. So I think digital efficacy will actually be, I think, the part and parcel to the kind of words that we need out there. And I would also say international cooperation and international policy. I think everything we talked about has been very domestic oriented, but our ability to cooperate internationally is going to actually help us drive whether or not something is used for the good or it's weaponized against us. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, thank you all so much. I know that we are just now out of time. So big virtual round of applause for our wonderful panelists. Also a plug to please be sure to follow the Brookings issues. Please be sure to follow the Brookings podcast called Tech Tank. That's where you can follow further discussion of all these issues that we just talked about today. You can sign up on the website or listen on Spotify and Google. Thank you all so much.